Hello, good morning, and welcome. If you're like me, and I know I am, you're probably wondering, isn't it the last day of the quarter? So isn't this the last lesson on church history? The answer is yes. Yay!
No.
School's out.
No.
School's out for summer. School's out forever. So, we have finished our bus tour of 250 years of church history, and we pulled up to Independence Hall in Philadelphia in 1776, 250 years ago. Coincidence? I don't think so. Would somebody read Psalm 33, verses 10 through 12? Anyone who's got a Bible or a phone?
What is it,
33? 33, 10 through 12.
The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stand forever, the plans of his heart to all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he has chosen as his heritage.
All right, so today we are at the point where the 13 colonies declare themselves an independent nation. Just a reminder, all of the PDFs, all the slides, and all of the recordings are at billpetra.com/compass, and the recordings have a microphone in front of them. The slides are over here, and any additional readings based on articles I've written that would be helpful here. So this is what the website looks like. All 20 lessons. Each of these are links to articles I've written on my website that might be useful for additional research. I also have a partial bibliography here, and I want to call your attention to two books. People come and ask me, well, what could I read to learn more? There's a book called American Scripture by Pauline Mayer. She's a historian, and although it's about 30 years old, it is the most up-to-date treatment of the meaning and the development of the Declaration of Independence, which we're going to study today. It's called American Scripture, and as I mentioned last week, in a real sense, the Declaration of Independence is secular American Scripture. Also, there's a new book out by Walter Isaacson. Now, you've heard of lots of books he's written. He's first a journalist and also has written a number of biographies, Elon Musk, Einstein, Steve Jobs, Ben Franklin. And he's written a book called The Greatest Sentence Ever. And it's about the second sentence in the introduction to the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. It's 70 pages long, and it's about one sentence out of the Declaration of Independence. It's popular. It's much more approachable. It's not as scholastic. He's very much into public policy and spends some time talking about that in this book. Finally, I want to draw your attention to these two books. People have asked, what is the best book I could read on church history that is comprehensive enough to cover all of church history, and it's not superficial? And it would be this two-volume set called Invitation to Church History by John Hanna. John Hanna is the head of the history department at Dallas Seminary. I met him about 50 years ago. Took a church history class that he taught to the staff of Campus Crusade for Christ. A couple years later, I was his teaching assistant. And we became friends, and I consider him my mentor in church history. I get together with him every couple of years and ask him my hard questions on church history. About 20 years ago, we took a bus tour of Reformation history around Europe. We went all over Germany looking at where Martin Luther lived and worked. We went to Switzerland for Zwingli and Calvin. We went to France. We went to Rome. How does Rome fit into the Reformation? Well, it was the building of St. Peter's at a cost of $50 million that caused the Pope to sell indulgences. And that's what the 95 Theses were about, the selling of indulgences. In any event, I helped Dr. Hanna start this. His wife sent me a note saying, he hasn't started this. It is his magnum opus. He's written a number of other books, but I think this is the best. I contributed some content to these books, a small amount of content, and I think it's the best that you can read.
Bill,
yes.
Do you have links to those on your website?
Yes. In fact, if you click on this link, it'll take you to Amazon. How convenient. And then I have links to which of the lessons this book relates to. I have an older bibliography that I haven't updated for a while down here. Okay.
Bill?
Yes?
Let's hear your slides. Look at the slide. Is it everything on the same slide that you have projected?
Say again.
Is everything, maybe I'm not seeing you right. Is everything on that slide that you've been talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
But these are the lessons, and at the bottom is a link to the bibliography, which points back to the lesson that I'm referring to. Okay. Church history. Our objectives. By the end of this session, you should be able to evaluate the Declaration of Independence and appraise the faith of half a dozen of the founding fathers. When we talk about the founding fathers, we're talking about the framers. I've written, ironically, a number of articles on this. An article on the Declaration of Independence that will come out July the 4th. An article on the Constitution. And an article on several of the leading founding fathers. We'll talk about all of them today, except for, let's see. We'll talk about all of these guys. All right. There are three kinds of people in this world. Those who can count and those who cannot. When we talk about the faith of our fathers, which fathers are we talking about? Well, there are two different kinds. They're the planting fathers, the Puritan fathers, going all the way back to the 1630s. And then there's what we call the founding fathers or the framers. Those were the men during the Revolutionary War that played a significant role in our history. Those that signed the Declaration of Independence, there were 56 of those. But these two kinds of fathers differed in their view of faith. The planting fathers said that faith should be personal, but public. And the idea is that by having a public faith, it would be a witness to other people. The founding fathers, on the other hand, they said it should be personal and private. Notice the difference. The planting fathers, they wanted to change society. The founding fathers were more interested in individual rights. Hence the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. All right, let me just say that of these founding fathers, 56, most of them were born in America. Most were Anglo-Saxon Protestants. One was Catholic. There were some deists. Most were well-educated and prosperous. Most were in their 30s or 40s. The age spread was from 26 to 81. Most of them had children, so they were fathers in that sense. Most were lawyers by training, though not all served as lawyers. Even Ben Franklin studied the law. Most were churchmen. We don't use that term much anymore, but it means that they attended church. Some of them served in their churches. One of them was a clergyman, an active clergyman. Four of them studied for the ministry. Most were Southerners. Most of the Southerners were of the planter class. That means they had plantations and they owned slaves. Between a quarter and a third of them were involved in agriculture or were members of the landed gentry. That means they owned land. And a third of them had inherited wealth. All right, the drafters of the Declaration of Independence. There was a motion at the Continental Congress that we should write a Declaration of Independence from England. This did not start the Revolutionary War. The Revolutionary War had been going on for a year already, all the way back to April 19th, the Battle of Lexington. So they appointed five men to write a Declaration of Independence. All of these men had studied the law all of them were lawyers. Franklin had studied the law but didn't practice it. And here they are. Roger Sherman, representing Connecticut. He was a Calvinist, 66 years old. He signed the 1774 Articles of Association. He signed the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation in 1776, which was our first constitution, and then the actual Constitution of America in 1787. He attended an old light church. That means a church that was not particularly open to revivalists in New Medford. He became moderator of his church. His church was pastored by John Edwards Jr., kind of convenient, who embraced New Light. So he became kind of a New Lightist. He was a strong Republican, except he was more Federalist on issues of economics and commerce. Robert T. Livingston was 30 years old. He was a lawyer, a politician. He administered the oath of office to George Washington when he became president. Pretty cool. The Bible he used, he was a Freemason, and the Bible he used was a Freemason Bible. And it is still in the library of the Freemason Temple in New York. And sometimes they cart it out for current presidential oaths. Think of that. He was also a diplomat to France and negotiated the Louisiana Purchase that significantly expanded the scope of America during the presidency of Thomas Jefferson. Turns out that Napoleon needed money to prosecute his wars in Europe, and so for the mere cost of $15 million, we got the Louisiana Purchase. Yay! Think of the gumbo. We had Benjamin Franklin, who was a free thinker. We'll talk about him in more detail. He was from Pennsylvania, and he was a deist. John Adams, representing Massachusetts, was by this time a Unitarian, grew up in a Puritan household. We'll talk about him more. And Thomas Jefferson, yay, from the great state of Virginia, who at this point declared that he was a Unitarian. Now, as we said, deists shared many of the religious ideas of the Unitarians, but the Unitarians thought that God was more personal. Deists said that God is the creator who made the universe like a giant clock, set it in motion, governed by natural laws, and then hung a sign on the door saying, out to lunch. Unitarians had churches. There are no deist churches. Unitarians found God to be more personal, thought that some of the miracles in the Bible were true, that they had actually happened. The deists, no, he's a clockmaker, and the universe runs only on natural laws, which makes miracles impossible. All righty. Here's a famous picture of the Declaration of Independence. This is the president of the Continental Congress, John Hancock, and this is Thomas Jefferson with red hair handing him the finished Declaration of Independence that they had spent weeks on. On his right is Benjamin Franklin, behind him John Adams and the other two. That's the Committee of Five. This is the draft that Thomas Jefferson wrote. You will notice that there are many amendations and corrections. He spent 17 days writing this by himself. What was interesting is Franklin was the oldest of all the Committee of Five, but John Adams was kind of the senior member. And so it was expected that he would write the Declaration of Independence, or at least the first draft. But he said, Thomas Jefferson is the best writer of the group, number one. Number two, he's from Virginia, the most important colony of all the 13 colonies. And it's important that a Virginian write this. And so he was appointed to write the first draft of the Declaration of Independence. Now, is the Declaration of Independence influenced by the Enlightenment, by the Age of Reason, by rationalism, or is it influenced by the Great Awakening and the Christian faith? It's safe to say that the Revolution would not have occurred, nor been successful, or been able to sustain itself on the strength of only one of these groups. Both of them played a part. They both argued for a revolution using a compelling religious framework, assuring the devotees that their efforts and their fighting for freedom and even dying for the cause of independence would be looked upon with favor from heaven. Even the Unitarians thought this. One pastor said, the principal seat of the glorious kingdom which Christ shall erect upon earth in the latter days would be enabled by this Declaration of Independence. So was it motivated by Christian ideas or by enlightened ideas? Well, the answer is complex, and I wish we could spend the next 6 months talking about it. But we can primarily answer that it was motivated by Christian ideas. Much of the theological underpinnings were theological arguments advanced by Christians. If you look at references to literature that was used by politicians during this time, 34% of the quotes come from the Bible, mostly from the Old Testament, mostly from the book of Deuteronomy. So even when rationalists fueled the independent movement, they often employed, if not the exact words, certainly the prevailing tone of Orthodox Christianity. So when the Declaration of Independence was approved, we said that it was voted on July the 2nd. It was printed on July the 4th. And so at the top, it says July the 4th. And then it started being promoted on July the 5th and July the 6th. And the way it was done is it was read in the town square. It was read aloud. In fact, even Washington, who was stationed in New York fighting against the Brits, had some of his officers stand up and read portions of it. So I want you to picture in your mind that you are in the town square and you are hearing these words read aloud. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitles them, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, the governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. That whether any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish that and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress, assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor. So what do you think? Is this a Christian document? Is it a biblical document? What do you think? I want you to notice in red are Thomas Jefferson's original words. But when it went to Congress, they said there isn't enough mention of God. So they added two more in green. Now, when I pray to God, I don't say, dear nature's God, nor do I say creator. I use more personal names. I don't say supreme judge. I don't say divine providence when I pray. But these words were written in such a way so as not to offend either deists or Christians. But I want you to see in italics the laws of nature, not the laws of the Bible. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Does the Bible promise those things?
No.
No. Now, this is taken from John Locke's Life, Liberty, and Property, but Benjamin Franklin condensed this. Benjamin Franklin and John Adams. John Adams had quite a hand in editing this. They went to Ben Franklin, who was upstairs. He had terrible bouts of gout. He enjoyed the good life. And they asked him to help polish this down. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Does it say this in the book of Romans? No, it says God places them there. It is the right of the people to abolish that government. So this is a document that is a compromise satisfying all parties. Nature's God comes from John Locke. Creator comes from Jefferson, Supreme Judge. That was added by Congress. Now, I told you last week that there was a whole section at the end of the Declaration of Independence that talked about 27 different grievances they had with King George III. And amongst those grievances, Jefferson wrote about the terrible sin of slavery. But South Carolina and Georgia would not sign this document with that in there. So all of that was jettisoned from the Declaration of Independence before it's published. The language is elastic. It was believed that the states will preserve our particular issues of Christianity, and we'll talk about that. Alexander Hamilton, when asked why he left Christ out of the Declaration of Independence, he said, "We forgot. There's no mention of God in the Constitution." Well, that's not quite true. There's a mention of Jesus. At the very bottom of the Constitution, it says, "In the year of our Lord." But it does have a profound understanding of the depravity of man, so that there's the balance of powers, there are checks and balances, there are three different branches of the government. So there was a real Calvinistic understanding that went into putting that together. So this is what it looked like. This is one of the Dunlop broadsides. So Benjamin Franklin had retired as a printer, but he found a printer who would print 200 copies, and they're huge. They're probably about this tall, 200 copies. And John Hancock, who was the president of the Continental Congress, signed first. And this document was not the establishment of a form of government. We think that the Declaration happened on July the 4th, and on the July the 5th, then we wrote the Constitution. No, it was years later, 1787, that they sat down to write this, to fix the Articles of Confederation, which weren't working at all. Every state was allowed to negotiate their own foreign trade. There was no common courtesy. There was no way to raise a national militia. And so they threw it out, and they came up instead with the Constitution. But this document and the eloquence with which it was written has had such an impact on the American psyche that 67 years later, when Abraham Lincoln spoke at the cemetery in Gettysburg, he said, 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, 1776, conceived in liberty, dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now, the Declaration of Independence did not assure that all men were created equal. The Civil War, which cost close to 620,000 lives, including the 7,000 that were buried in the Gettysburg Cemetery that he was there to dedicate. It was the Civil War that brought slavery to an end in America. Let's now look at some of the founding fathers. Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin said, "God governs in the affairs of men." Good old Ben. But Ezra Stiles, who was the president of Yale and a Puritan, knew that Franklin had deist leanings, and he wanted to pin him down because Franklin was very nimble-footed. And in friendship, Stiles asked him for some kind of a creedal confession, however limited. Franklin, who said that this was the first time that anyone had ever asked him, readily obliged. "Here's my creed. I believe in one God, creator of the universe, that he governs the world by the providence, that he ought to be worshiped, that the most acceptable service we can render to him is doing good to his other children, that the soul of man is immortal and will be treated with justice in another life, respecting its conduct in this one. These I take to be the fundamental principles of all sound religion, not just Christianity. And I regard them as you do in whatever sect I meet with them. Well, that wasn't quite enough. Ezra Stiles pressed to find out, is he really a Christian or not? Franklin said, Jesus taught the best system of morals the world had ever saw. But I have some doubts as to Jesus' divinity, he said, and I think it needless to busy myself with it now. This was 5 weeks before he died. When I expect soon an opportunity of knowing the truth with less trouble. Now, how do you burn a heretic like that? When he was a young man, when he was in his 20s, he wrote his own epitaph. Have any of you written your own epitaph? Here's Franklin's. The body of Benjamin Franklin Printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out, stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms. But the work shall not be lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, revised and corrected by the author. How would you like that on your epitaph? That wasn't on his epitaph. This is his epitaph. Benjamin and Deborah Franklin. That's it. Toward the end of his life, he said, that's all I want. Thousands of people came to his funeral. He was that renowned. He never married his wife. She had been previously married, and her husband disappeared into the Caribbean somewhere. They could never find him. So they were common law married. He spent much of his marriage in Europe, in France, and England. They had an illegitimate son together. He had an illegitimate son. Franklin's illegitimate son favored the Brits and ultimately went to live in England. Here's John Adams, born in Braintree, Massachusetts, Quincy. Grew up in a Puritan home, but when many of those in the Congregational church that he attended steered toward a liberal Unitarianism, he did too. Very influenced by the Enlightenment, to be good and to do good is all we have to do. That's all we have to do? I do not attach much importance to creeds, because I believe he cannot be wrong whose life is right. Now, how does this grab you? Is this the gospel you would share with someone? But many of the founding fathers thought that it was important that Americans be virtuous. I think I mentioned last week that Ben Franklin wrote a list of virtues that he wanted to cultivate in his life. And someone said to him, well, you left one out. Well, which one is that? Humility. So he added that to it. And after a while, he realized, no, this doesn't come from my heart, and I'm not a humble man. But the idea that virtuousness is all that is necessary was baked into the thinking of many of the founding fathers. On the topic of predestination, if there is no liberty, there is no responsibility. No virtue, no vice, no merit or demerit, no reward, and no punishment. So he was familiar with Calvinism. He was brought up in that. But he said, modern priests, whether they're popesical, meaning Roman Catholic, or Presbyterian, they demonstrate little tolerance and less charity. They believe that salvation can be contained in a vial. I said, nah, that's not true. Ultimately, the government is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. Second president of the United States. First president of the United States, George Washington. Of all the founding fathers, he had the least to say about religion when asked. Like most members of the Virginia gentry, he was baptized, married, and buried in the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church. He wore his denominational labels rather lightly. He kept his religion private. strictly private religion, didn't talk about it. In politics, as in religion, he wrote, "My tenets are few and simple." He was president for only two terms. He did not altogether avoid the language of religion, but it was a public or civil religion that he addressed, doing so in language that demonstrated no great passion. Now, he kept a personal prayer diary. You've probably seen pictures of him kneeling in the snow at Valley Forge. Nice picture, never happened. But he wrote this: "God would accept him because of the merits of thy son, Jesus Christ." What do you think about that? I think he had the real disease. In all my readings on Washington, it's hard to parse what he wrote, but I think he was a real Christian. He attended church inconsistently, never took communion. Ooh, why? On God, he said, he called him the great architect, the governor of the universe, and the supreme dispenser of all good. You pray that way in your daily devotions, right? When some Presbyterian leaders complained to Washington that the Constitution had no references to the only true God in Jesus Christ, whom he had sent, the nation's first president calmly replied, "The path of true piety is so plain as to require but little political direction." His aloofness and his broad tolerance added to his enormous appeal as the nation's leader, but they leave us in the dark a little bit about what he specifically believed. But after two terms, he stepped down. He was elected unanimously. That's never happened before. He was elected unanimously. He left the public stage after he was president, and his farewell address talked about religion and morality are indispensable supports in a republic. And Napoleon was stunned that he would step down. When Washington died, they had celebrations in France. George III said, "If he steps down after only two terms, he will be the greatest man in the world." France had 10 days of mourning when Washington died. John Witherspoon, we've talked about him, descendant of John Knox, Scottish Presbyterian minister, was called from Edinburgh, Scotland, to be president of Princeton. He signed the Declaration of Independence, the only active clergyman, the only college president to do so. He helped draft the Articles of Confederation, and he supported the Constitution as a representative, an elective representative of the state of New Jersey. And he educated James Madison, Aaron Burr, dozens, 37 judges, 10 cabinet members, 12 members of the Continental Congress, 28 U.S. senators, 49 congressmen. He had an incredible impact as a pastor, but as a political activist. He supported George III against the revolutionaries when he lived in Scotland, and he fought against George III as an American. James Madison, he said this. Now remember, he studied under Witherspoon. "Freedom arises from the multiplicity of denominations which pervade America and which is the best and only security for religious liberty in any society. For where there is such a variety of sects, there cannot be a majority of any one sect to oppress and persecute the rest." He had read theology with some care, even after he graduated from college. But 50 years later, they asked him, "So what do you think about God and his attributes?" And he said, "You know, I got caught up in the revolution, and Haven't really thought about it for the last 50 years. Thomas Jefferson, our final one. Thomas Jefferson is my favorite. Not that I idolize him, but I'm fascinated by him. There was a book by Joseph Ellis, a renowned historian, called The American Sphinx. And it's the life of Jonathan Edwards, and he's amazing. For the last 50 years of his life, he read the New Testament daily in Greek and Latin and French. Why would you read it in French? To show off. I am a real Christian, sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others. So he's got the real disease, right? The Trinity, mere abracadabra. Jesus' miracles, vulgar ignorance and fabrication. They did not occur. Calvin introduced more absurdities into the Christian religion than can readily be imagined. So, probably wasn't a Presbyterian. The prophecies of Revelations are the ravings of a maniac. I trust that there is not a young man now living in the United States who will not die a Unitarian. I am of a sect by myself, as far as I know. So toward the end of his life, he got out a razor and glue and went through the New Testament, went through the Gospels, and removed all the miracles, removed all the angels, and produced what is now called the Jefferson Bible, as he entitled it, The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted textually from the Gospels in Greek, Latin, French, and English, the languages they originally written in. And after he died, he asked it be published and a copy handed out to all of the congressmen. It was done again back in the 50s. Interesting. You can see the original if you go to his home in Monticello, Virginia. Now, here's what he said about religion. Our rulers can have no authority over such natural rights, only as we have submitted to them in a social compact. That's important. Only the social compact that we agree to. The rights of conscience, we never submitted. We could not submit. We are answerable for them to our God. Well, that sounds pretty good, right? But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say that there are 20 gods or no gods. Well, this got him in trouble. He was running for president in 1800 against John Adams, the incumbent president. And John Adams and his people took this, published it in the newspapers, and said, "Are you going to elect an atheist?" It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there's no God. And so he had to fight against this. He was called an enemy to pure morals and religion, consequently an enemy to his country and to his God. Boy, if we thought this way today. In Monticello, down at the end of the lawn, just overlooking the hill, where at the bottom of the hill is the University of Virginia, which he started, the first secular college. On his tombstone are written the three things he wanted to be remembered for. Author of the Declaration of American Independence, he wrote the first draft. And the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, meaning you don't have to be a member of the Anglican Church in order to serve in government. And finally, Father of the University of Virginia. Now, at the federal level, in the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof at the federal level, but not at the state level. If you wanted to be a member of the government of Delaware, every person who shall be chosen a member of either house or to any office or place of trust shall also make and subscribe to the following declaration, to wit, I do profess faith in God the Father and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, and in the Holy Spirit. This is taken right out of the Nicene Creed. One God, blessed forevermore, and I do acknowledge the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testament be given by divine inspiration. Wow, you need to confess this in order to be an elder in our church. This is the kind of stuff that happened at the state level, but not the federal level. So what's the difference? We said there are two wings that propelled us into the revolution, Christianity and the Enlightenment. They agreed for different reasons. So the separation of church and state, Christianity believed, was to protect the elect because man is evil. But the Enlightenment, the rationalist, believed that the separation of church and state was to permit man to be autonomous because man is basically good. Alex de Tocqueville, most often French scholar quoted and least often read, wrote in Democracy in America, Volume 2, the following. He came to America and was fascinated by it. Said, there's no country in the world in which the Christian religion retains a greater influence over the souls of men than in America. The reason America is great is because it has a Christian soul. Dr. David Noble of Summit Ministry says, but America has a secular mind. And that's true. During my career in high tech, I traveled over 2 million air miles, and I visited 55 countries. I've spoken before Chinese generals in Beijing, professors in Taiwan, university students in Saudi Arabia, rabbis in Tel Aviv, businessmen in Moscow. I've trained salespeople in London, Ireland, Milan, Athens, South Africa, Zimbabwe, of all the countries I visited. There's nothing like the United States, not even lip service. It is the number one destination in the world for foreign immigrants. Since 1965, they're coming to America. 70 million foreign immigrants have come to America. The U.S. had no other country at the time as a model, though it has been used since as a model for other countries. The founding fathers were advised by their religion, the original Judeo-Christian metaphysical worldview. Let me close with one-word summaries. Pilgrims came by separating from the Church of England. Puritans still believed the Church of England was the right church, but didn't worship correctly. And they wanted a more pure form of worship. In America, denominations are inclusive, not exclusive. Sects and cults are exclusive. Whitfield was dramatic in his preaching during the Great Awakening. Wesley was very methodical. Jonathan Edwards preached about the glory of God. The Great Awakening was like a fire that swept over the colonies. The Enlightenment was a time of rationalism. Deism believed in a mechanistic God. The Declaration of Independence declared us a nation. And the Constitution made us a republic. Any questions before we close? Yes.
Slide 13. That gravestone.
Slide 13.
Yes. Well, that's what it said at the bottom.
It does.
Next one.
Next one forward. This gray stone.
Are those bullet holes?
No, they're coins. People throw pennies. What happens though is that when it rains, it kind of stains the stone, so they have to clear those off.
Just curious.
You know, throw a coin on Ben Franklin's body. Lucky you. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
No, not a question, but a comment on behalf of Compass. Anyone here, one who's been here for the last 2 quarters, thank you.
Amen.